Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to switch our attention. We're still talking about water, but we're going to go to groundwater and visit with you about groundwater awareness with Steve Alice. Steve is Section Chief for Private Water Supply with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Stephen, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Morning, Larry. Thanks for the chance to be here.
And Kevin Masaryk is the Outreach Specialist at the Center for Watershed Science and Education at the UW-Stevens Point. Kevin, great to see you.
You too, Larry.
Thanks. Thank you both so much. When we're talking about groundwater, maybe just quick, it never hurts to define it and how it kind of relates to our, and how does it relate to the water table?
Groundwater is basically that water that's present under the Earth's surface. It's in the cracks and the pores between the sand grains, and usually the water table is reflected at the ground surface at the level of our lakes, our rivers, streams in the state.
And when we think about our daily water needs, our groundwater covers, a large percentage of our people in the state rely on it, do they not?
Yeah, Milwaukee and then the Green Bay area are surface water systems. There's several other surface water systems, but Madison, Janesville, Beloit, Wausau, many of those are all groundwater systems.
Yeah, so a pretty large percentage.
It amounts to, I think, about 70% of the population that relies on groundwater as their primary water source.
There was something you guys put out called Dispelling Groundwater Myths, which I thought was pretty cool. What are some of those myths about groundwater? Kevin, maybe you can start that.
Well, there's just a lot of myths that go back way back when. Some of them that groundwater travels in underground veins or underground rivers. And we know that's simply not true. It's just local precipitation that infiltrates down into the ground. That water travels through the empty spaces in the soil or the void spaces in the rock. Other ones that we hear quite often are my well water taps into groundwater that comes from Canada or Lake Superior, and that's not true either. It's local precipitation. Most groundwater infiltrates the land surface and travels to the closest nearby river, lake, or stream.
So it's all local.
Pretty
much.
You
want to take care of your local water.
Pretty much, yeah. The recharge zones of that area where that rainwater or snow infiltrates into the ground is generally within a few miles of where it's used.
Oh. Well, there are some easy, not very expensive ways. I mean, think about, by the way, Groundwater Awareness Week is
this week.
Next week.
March 11th through the 17th.
I was trying to remember. I didn't think it was this week. It's next week. And it's not a, and I think it's a good thing for us to really think about. I mean, you turn the tap on, you don't really think too often about that water.
Yeah, Kevin and I appreciate the opportunity to come the last few years this week because it allows us to sort of remind folks that an annual bacteria test from their well is really a great idea. And using Groundwater Awareness Week using your show and other tools to get that message out to folks. You know, bacteria test is in the $25 to $35 range. It's a really small cost for the investment, the knowledge that you get. And then the other thing that if people are unaware of, say, the nitrate levels in their well or the metals level in their well, again, this is a good time of year to collect that sample. You can call any of the state-certified labs, and they'll give you a sample kit with instructions as to how to collect the sample and send it back to them.
And Steve's point about the testing is a good one. That gets on to one of the other groundwater myths, which is just because my water tastes good, looks clean, means it's safe to drink.
Yeah.
A lot of these contaminants that we're talking about, the only way to know that if they're in your water or not is to have them tested.
Yeah, and sometimes the other way is true too. Sometimes the water may not taste.
It might have a taste to it, but it's perfectly safe.
But it could be perfectly
right.
safe.
There may be iron or other things that are affecting the taste of it, but it's not a health issue.
You can join in too with 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. By the way, you mentioned water sampling and taking a water sample. Judith posted a video on how to properly take a water sample. So that's one of the things you
guys
put it together.
That's a video that the DNR put together a couple years ago. I think it was, I can't remember, it was 2008 or 2009. But during the period where we had all the extensive flooding in western Wisconsin, southwest Wisconsin, we were we put the video together to give people a fairly simple a way to look at what is the proper way to collect a sample.
Well, that's pretty cool,
actually. It's three and a half minutes long, and it just, if somebody sits and watches that a couple of times, they'll get it right.
You got it. You got it. All right. Laura and Arpin, we turn to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, thank you. About 4 years ago, we built a house and had to put in a well. We had the water tested at that time for fluoride because we've got young kids, and it tested that we had adequate amounts. But at this year's well check, the doctor asked if we knew if we have to retest for that or not. And so I was calling to find out if we tested good for fluoride once, is that something that tends to stay, or is that something like bacteria that needs to be tested for regularly?
What do you think, Kevin?
Fluoride's one of those things. Fluoride's kind of interesting because the reason why dentists and doctors ask you to test for it is because it's generally lacking in Wisconsin's groundwater. There are some areas where there is naturally occurring fluoride, and if that's the case, the amount of supplements that they would prescribe would be less. Generally speaking, because it is a geologic source, we wouldn't expect it to change much over time, but if there was concern, it's a fairly inexpensive test. I think $20 to $25 at your average lab is what you'd be looking to pay if you wanted to check to see if that level has changed at all.
Yeah, you might try it a second time, and if it's the same, then I probably wouldn't worry too much about it again.
Yeah, particularly since it's a naturally occurring mineral.
There
shouldn't be a reason for it to change much.
When we look at things like hardness, calcium and magnesium, when we look at those constituents over time, generally speaking, they don't change too much or too dramatically from year to year.
Yeah. Okay. There you go, Laura.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Willem in Colfax, hi to you.
Hi. I was concerned about our groundwater because the way that I understand the way it works is that in this area, western Wisconsin, we're all tapping into the same aquifer, and there's been a lot of pressure on due to frac sand mining and their high-capacity wells and the fact that the DNR can only permit single wells without, they can't really take in effect the cumulative effect of these wells on our aquifer. So I'm really concerned about that, and I was wondering what your guest might think about that.
Stephen?
Sure. Each high-capacity well that does come in, we do review on the impacts of that individual well on an area. That is something that we're taking a closer look at this last several months as a result of a recent court decision. What I can tell you is that is something the department's looking at more closely. We are aware that there are some, while generally Wisconsin has plenty of water, there are areas of the state where using too much water is starting to occur. And in our high-capacity well review process, we're starting to look at each well and screen it and try to determine what, if any, impacts those wells will have.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And I believe the DNR magazine had a piece on actually surface lakes, and the question was whether or not the groundwater was being potentially tapped that was affecting the surface lakes in some areas.
Certainly any high-capacity well that pumps, as we entered or started the show, the water table is a reflection in many cases of the at the lake level.
Yeah.
And so you've got a high-capacity well that's pumping, it can certainly draw water from a lake.
Bill in Outagamie County, it's your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for this program.
Sure.
I want to ask your guest, I live in Outagamie County, and I live a mile away from a factory farm that has 7,000 cows, and they draw out of two high-capacity deep wells probably about 1 million gallons of water a day. And twice a year, they pump these pits that they use this water for to flush the manure into these pits. They spread it on all the land around here. And my question is, how long is before that E. coli from that manure is going to show up in my well, and why is the DNR so strict on other things? But it seems to me like when it comes to agriculture, that the agriculture department in Wisconsin trumps the DNR. They look the other way, and when my well goes bad, I'm just going to be kind of out of luck.
Hmm.
Well, a couple things there. One, all of these high, large confined animal feeding operations, they will have to have a discharge permit for their manure spreading. There are each of the fields that they spread on have to be pre-approved by the department, so we're aware of the geology in those areas. Generally, E. coli, once they're spread on the ground surface, they don't tend to live very long. So the idea there is that by spreading far enough away from wells, the filtering capacity of the soil, if they spread at a point where, they want the manure to spread to be stay in place so that it acts as a soil nutrient and a fertilizer and helps the composition of the soil, organic matter in the soil. That's the idea, is that all those things are taken into account. So, while certainly there have been a number of manure contaminated wells, and if just to anybody, not just the caller, if you believe your well has become contaminated with manure, if it becomes brown, foamy, smelly, we want you to call the DNR. We really want to learn about those cases. So that's just a message to go out to everybody. But getting back to the specifics, each of those high-capacity farms, in their discharge permit for their manure, their fields are approved, the location they can spread are approved. That's not to say they don't sometimes cause problems, but many of those factors that you mentioned are all considered when that discharge permit is issued. The amount of manure can be spread, all of that is taken into account with the goal of keeping the manure in place and not affecting groundwater quality.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Bill. Appreciate it. Benny in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. How you doing? Well, I got a comment. It's, I'm working on this company on Milwaukee, and it's a chemical company. And after me being complaining about the air pollution, it was all the chemicals in the air, and they have everything closed up, all the windows, everything. They don't got no system to release all these aromas or whatever coming from all these chemicals, and you end up breathing deeply and everything hurt inside, and they dumping all the chemicals inside the sewer, where the sewer is inside their company, but it's the public sewers.
I guess your question isn't directly related to groundwater, but what I would say is that if you've got a very specific information that something is being dumped illegally, the DNR does have a helpline. You can call that number. I would recommend if you have concerns about your, the breathing and working environment, obviously start with the company you work for. And from there, if you don't get anywhere, then I think talking to Milwaukee County Health Department and raising an issue that way. The DNR's helpline is 1-888-936-7463. It's our help number. We have a separate number for reporting spills. I can't remember what that is right now. But if you call the helpline...
what is it again? 936?
Yep, 888-936-7463.
Okay, 7463. Yeah, and he was talking about, he was thinking that the company itself was dumping chemicals inside the plant down the sewer.
Yeah, and again, that's something that obviously Milwaukee Met, the sewage department, would want to know about, because sure, if those chemicals are being dumped above permitted standards, that type of thing, certainly it could have an impact on killing bacteria at the treatment plant, other operations at the treatment plant.
Thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Steve Alice, who is section chief for private water supply with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Kevin Masaryk, who is the outreach specialist at the Center for Watershed Science and Education at the UW Stevens Point, as we visit with them today about groundwater. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page, post there at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network. Right up until 12 o'clock today, we're going to be talking about our groundwater with our two guests, Stephen Ellis and Kevin Masaryk. Great to have them back during this time. Next week is a Groundwater Awareness Week. They're hoping that people, if you've got a well, that you're going to get that well tested. Now is a good time to do that, get it tested for, well, for all kinds of things. Yep. Bacteria primarily, though.
Primarily bacteria. We always recommend an annual bacteria test.
No, and we even have a little video on our website, or at least a link to our video on the website that shows you how to do it. So got that as well. And Valerie in Maple has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, Val.
Hi, Larry. I have a question, which is just a little tangential to Wisconsin, and that's about the Ogallala Aquifer. And at one time, the Army Corps of Engineers was talking about trying to recharge it from Lake Superior, and the reason they wanted to do it is because we're mining that water for agricultural purposes with irrigation. Especially, the big sprinkle systems. We do a lot of that in Wisconsin, so I have a few related questions. One is, what exactly is the Ogallala Aquifer? How extensive is it? How interconnected is it? In the kind of irrigation that we do in Wisconsin, how badly are we mining into our underground aquifers? And is it possible to switch to drip irrigation for some of the applications that we're using it for, because it uses a lot less water? I took a course in the early 90s, and basically my geology professor was saying we are badly abusing our underground water, and we're mining it. We're using it way more. We're drawing out more than we can possibly bring back, recharge from rainwater. So starting with the Ogallala, but then generally, how is agriculture affecting?
Yeah. Sure. Okay, let's turn to Kevin Masaryk first here. Kevin?
Well, the Ogallala and the Wisconsin aquifers are completely separate, so we'll start there. But starting with the Ogallala, if we look at that region, it's a little bit more arid. They don't receive as much precipitation, and it is an area where they do irrigate pretty heavily. As a result, they're actually mining groundwater. Groundwater levels are lowering and sinking, and I think in the past number of years, the agricultural practices are changing from a lot of irrigated agriculture to more grazing operations, so they're adapting to that decrease in water use. Wisconsin agriculture, Wisconsin aquifers are a little bit different. We're a little bit more humid climate. Therefore, we're not in danger necessarily of continuing to draw down our aquifers. In Wisconsin, the real issue is what effect is irrigation having on the water table, which might mean a decrease in feet or tens of feet because of agriculture. And that decrease in the water table is going to have impacts to lakes, rivers, and streams is the main concern, not necessarily that we're going to ever run out of groundwater in Wisconsin. So it's important to distinguish between those two issues. In terms of recharging the Ogallala from Lake Superior, that will not happen. The Great Lakes Compact, which is an agreement between the states and the provinces of Canada, prevents water from being diverted from the basin for that type of purpose.
Yeah. And as we take a look at the kind of irrigation systems, she was talking about sort of overhead watering systems that we've all seen versus drip irrigation. Is there any movement to more drip irrigation?
I don't know about that. I think what may drive that question, you know, her first part of her question, how badly in Wisconsin are we mining the water? As I mentioned earlier, each high-capacity well application that comes in, we are now looking at the question of what is going to be the impact of this well on the local aquifer. But then secondly, what actually may drive changes to the different irrigation, I think, might be energy costs. You know, if a farmer can utilize less water by putting that water out more efficiently, they're going to save energy costs of pumping that water out of the ground. Now, we've not moved to that area yet, or maybe there are some sections of the state that have. I'm not familiar with irrigation technology and how it's used, but I would think that that would be a factor that would come into play. If you can get the same amount of crop growing for 500 gallons a minute as opposed to 1,000 gallons a minute, because the plant is better able, you're losing less through evaporation, I think that would be more what drives the change to different types of irrigation technology.
It's amazing the technology nowadays. We were out for dinner with some friends who farm, and we're at the restaurant, and he said, oh, I forgot to get the irrigation system going. So he gets on his phone, and he dials and gets a robotic female to answer and starts up watering various areas of and not other areas.
Yeah, that's a pretty high-tech irrigation system that's, you know, obviously got a web link.
Yeah.
And that the farmer can check when he turns it on, when he turns it off, and information like that.
And
I would caution, though, that technology can really only get us so far.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're talking about spray irrigation versus drip irrigation. There is some efficiency increase in terms of maybe the water going to the plant and less water being evaporated to the atmosphere. But there still comes a point where there might be too many straws in the aquifer, too many wells in the aquifer.
I can absolutely see that. It was interesting. He said it even if there's a problem, a leak, or if it breaks down, he gets a phone call.
Yeah.
And telling him exactly what happened and where. It's amazing. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I have two things. One is antibiotics people take and cows take. Some antibiotics, half of it goes right through you and just get pissed out. And that ends up in the groundwater. And, you know, I wonder if... And then also, I used to live real close to a ski hill. Every time they start making snow, my well went down quite a bit.
Yeah. Comments, Kevin?
Yeah, those are all concerns. I would say they're emerging concerns. The technology to look for some of those compounds, pharmaceuticals, hormones, antibiotics in groundwater is really just coming kind of into its own and becoming affordable for that type of research. But that's always a concern, is what percentage of what we take in, whether it's animals or humans for pharmaceuticals or antibiotics, what percentage does the body absorb versus excrete? And then where does it go? Some of those compounds are soluble, and we know that they're reaching groundwater and in small trace levels. But then there comes the toxicology. What effect do those small trace concentrations have on human health if we use that water for drinking? So I think those are all great points. And I think the research on that is still ongoing.
Yeah, still to be more testing needed on that one. Dot in Manitowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Dot.
Hi. I know we can't do anything about rain or snow, but what chemicals are there in each to make a difference in the groundwater? I use my water, or the rain and the snow, for my plants. And I'm always curious to know what chemicals are in those and how will affect the groundwater.
You know, in terms of rain or snow melt, I think those are for watering plants and watering gardens. I think they're a great option. They're a great use of that water. In terms of what might be in it, you know, there might be changes in pH because of dissolution of carbon dioxide that would lower the pH level. There might be a little bit of nitrate from atmospheric deposition that would increase the amount of nitrogen that goes to those plants. But in terms of other compounds and chemicals, I wouldn't have much of a concern for using that water for watering your plants or your garden.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Steve in Woodman, we are on to you now. Hi, Steve.
I live in southwest Wisconsin. And, well, I'm not a farmer, but I read a lot of different articles and stuff. And supposedly we have this karst geology where everything just runs straight through from the surface down into the water table. And there's lots of corn being grown and soybeans too. And supposedly this corn takes a lot out of the soil. So the farmers supposedly have to dump on fertilizer. And what about this atrazine that's a herbicide to kill the weeds? I've been reading that, well, I guess they use atrazine quite a bit out here where they grow corn.
Yeah. So effect of an herbicide like atrazine or atrazine itself, we have some research on that.
There's a lot of research on that. There is a groundwater quality standard for atrazine. And the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection has really been leading the charge on the atrazine research. I haven't looked in a while, a year or so, but I think on the DACCAP website, they used to have what they called atrazine prohibition areas listed. So an area, a person can look up, and in an atrazine prohibition area, the research, the data that DACCAP has looked at, they're finding too much groundwater or too much atrazine in groundwater. So they actually have the authority to prohibit the use of atrazine. So DACCAP has done a fair bit of testing around the state. I know that they're constantly moving around. They're checking and rechecking areas. So that might be a good place to first of all start and see if your home is in an atrazine prohibition area. If it is, I would definitely recommend you get a test. But even if it's not, what I tell folks, if you live in the country and you're, you know, near an agricultural cornfield, I haven't looked in a while. I think the atrazine test is still less than $50, Kevin.
For a atrazine screening tool, it's about $30.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty cheap to...
Pretty cheap. It's an easy test. You can call some state-certified labs, the State Lab of Hygiene, and they can send you a kit.
And with that, we are out of time. The time really flew by, Steve and Kevin. I hope you guys can come back and be with us again.
Thanks for having us.
In the meantime, Groundwater Awareness Week next week. Get your water tested, your groundwater tested for bacteria. Stephen Ellis is Section Chief for Private Water Supply with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Kevin Masaryk, Outreach Specialist at the Center for Watershed Science and Education at UW-Stevens Point. Coming up, the President of the United States.